All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it all into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online contributing writer Natasha Bogutsky.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online editor-in-chief Rich Dries. How's it going, Rich?
It's going pretty well. For the most part, I'm still fighting off a little bit of a congestion thing that I've been fighting with for about a week now.
I know.
You can probably hear it in my voice, right?
It's pretty grody.
Grody?
Yeah.
Last week was the discussion about Valley Girl, the movie, not this week.
Oh, you're going to have to take me back in time because I don't remember that discussion at all.
Oh, wow. I think it was where... We were talking about some other movie, and then I kind of equated it to a class thing involving, you know, similar to Valley Girl, the way Valley Girl is also a Romeo and Juliet style class story.
What? I don't remember any of that.
Well, then what you can do is go online and listen to past episodes of the Big Picture Podcast on our website at bigpicturepod.com or through your podcatcher of choice.
Hey. We don't plug till the end.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
You're skipping ahead on me.
Sorry about that. It's a really light news week this week, so there's not much to talk about there. I mean, we have Kerry Russell in possible talks for Star Wars Episode 9.
Not Kelly Preston, like I originally thought.
That's okay.
That was just a weird moment of, Kerry Russell's in talks for Star Wars. Really?
I am going to start screenshotting some of our messaging back and forth and putting them on in the show notes, because honestly, the prep for this show sometimes is, we try to make the show itself entertaining, but the prep for the show, God bless you.
Oh, no, it was a great moment of, well, she's worked with J.J. Abrams before in Mission Impossible 3, and I went, oh, Kerry Russell, who are you thinking of? Hold on. Google Jack Frost. Kelly Preston.
This is what I put up with, ladies and gentlemen.
And your review of her performance in Gotti wasn't all that great.
Well, it wasn't all that great a performance in Gotti.
Gotti wasn't a hell of a movie to begin with.
Nope. What else do we have in terms of like news this week? I mean, we had July 4th holiday right in the middle of the week, so that kind of disrupts the news cycle. Not a lot of business going on at the studios.
Not a single trailer dropped.
Miles Teller lands a role for Top Gun 2, playing the son of Goose from the first movie.
I will allow said joke.
I am not going to make that. Okay. If you're looking to cast someone to play the son of Goose, wouldn't Ryan Gosling be the better choice?
It's still like nails on the blackboard to me.
It's a beautiful, delightful pun.
No, unless you're a fan of horrible puns, but...
Well, yes, I am. And you had seen something, too, that you caught your eye.
Yeah, and slightly annoyed me as well. Earlier on this week, Den of Geek dropped an article saying the trailer for a film called Grinzy Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. I know, it's a hell of a name. The trailer just arrived.
Ta-da.
We had reviewed that said trailer back in February, if I remember correctly.
Pretty much, yeah.
But all of a sudden, Netflix has now acquired the rights to the film and will be releasing it later on this year. And all of a sudden, it's like, that trailer that we reviewed had disappeared off the face of the planet and a new one just magically popped up.
I think the deal there is some sites don't pay attention to smaller indie films like this looks to be, or character dramas or character light dramas, light comedies.
Well, then a geek
unless
is...
Unless it's going to show up on Netflix and then suddenly their attention is, you know, focused in on it because Netflix is the new shiny thing.
And if you can't hear my eye roll, just to let you know, it rivaled, what's his name, Clarence from The Office?
Indeed it does, ladies and gentlemen. And anything else that caught your eye this week?
Yes, actually. the film that is set to arrive later on this year around Christmas, Disney's The Nutcracker and the Four Realms, had a bit of a directorial change in their credits.
That's the one Lasse Hallström was directing, correct?
Yeah, with Keira Knightley, Mackenzie Foy, and Morgan Freeman.
Mm. Great lineup until you get to Morgan Freeman, and then...
That's something that I want to rant about that. I would like to write an article for Film Buff about...
Okay, pitch your editor.
About Me Too Society focusing mm-hmm. only on... I mean, yes, it was released about Morgan Freeman's misconduct of women on film as well, on film sets and such, but it was skated over. Is it mainly because he might be in a minority category?
Or he's... It's not even a case of being a beloved actor. I mean, because Kevin Spacey was a beloved actor, and yet he got shut down. And I wonder, is it because of the severity of the crimes? Because Kevin Spacey, underage boy, versus, well, at least these women were of age. It's not that, you know, there's a...
I don't think there should be a difference.
I don't think there's a parody in creepiness or anything like that. But, it's hard to... everybody says, well, each individual case, you know, matters. You don't have to make a blanket statement across the board. But are there rules?
Hence the article I'd like to write for Film Buff.
Okay. Okay. Start working up something and we will we'll take a look at it.
I will. But getting back to Nutcracker.
Nutcracker, yes.
It seems that Disney ordered a 32-day reshoot.
Wow.
Yes. Back in December of 2017. And Hallström was unable to perform said reshoots. So they brought in director Joe Johnston.
Because when I think of, let's reshoot some stuff for the Nutcracker, I think of the guy who directed The Rocketeer and Captain America the First Avenger.
Yes.
I mean, I like Joe Johnston's work, obviously. I love Captain America First Avenger. I love The Rocketeer beyond any kind of rational
great transition
yes.
scene.
Exactly. And, but he would not be the first... person on my list for reshooting and a Christmas ballet movie.
I hear it's supposed to be a lot darker, and there are elements from what I've seen that are not only fairy tale wise, but there's a vintage style to the trailer that mm-hmm. has been released so far. And can we talk about great transitions? As she's walking down the hallway, did you ever notice that the wallpaper changes from owls to mice midway through? And you can't even find where it happens.
No, I have not seen the trailer yet for this at all.
They've been showing it in the cinemas for months. It was
not in anything I've gone to see.
Did you see you didn't. We saw Greatest Showman at
a screening. Yeah, we didn't see it actually.
I saw it twice in the theater afterwards.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
But because of said reshoot changes, it was a long enough reshoot that they could order a credit change. So now Hallström will be sharing directorial credit with Joe Johnston on this film.
That's unusual.
It is, actually, because aren't there Director Guild of America's
rules? Yeah. They're the ones who do all the arbitration on that, too. If somebody comes in and directs, you know, the last 2 weeks of something or whatever, you know, like what happened with Bohemian Rhapsody or with Solo. The Directors Guild looks at what's been shot, who shot what. There's like a percentage formula involved. So it's very unusual that I'm kind of sound a little distracted because I'm sitting there trying to think, when was the last time we've seen something where two different directors are credited that aren't like the Coen brothers or the Wachowskis? You know, a directorial team like that, Pressburger and Powell. So it's I just can't think of any other time that this has happened before, off the top of my head. Now you're looking at the news piece on this right now.
Yes.
Do they say when the last time this happened?
No, they don't.
Hmm.
Wow. From what I'm seeing, all it says is Johnson's contributions to the film have become so significant that it justified the Directors Guild of America to waive its rule in which only one director or established directorial team can be billed as the director of the film. Indeed, the shared Nutcracker director billing is one that Hallstrom is embracing.
Which makes me wonder if Hallstrom argued for it in order to give Johnston some credit. Maybe Johnson only shot, well, what was it, 3 weeks of 31 days?
32 days.
32 days. That could have been, he could have shot almost up to half this movie. And I think it's if he had shot 51% of it, he would get the credit. And it might be a case where Johnston is a fan of Lasse Hallström's and was like, no, I can't do that to this guy. Or Hallström was just like, you know, he helped me out when I needed it. So can we do, you know, it sounds like somebody went to the Directors Guild and argued for this.
Well,
it doesn't sound like the Directors Guild in their magnanimity who said, okay, yeah, let's just split the credit. That doesn't seem like a guild thing to do. It sounds like somebody went in and argued for that. And I would be interested to find out who.
Well, Hallstrom did say it was an absolute blessing to have Joe Johnston step in when it became clear that I wouldn't be available for reshoots. Joe is the ultimate expert in visual effects, and I enjoy collaborating with him on this film.
There you go.
So I'm guessing he did argue a little.
Yeah. Sounds like, like I said, sounds like somebody did. It was probably Hallstrom. Bless him. Bless his heart. So, okay. But other than that, I like Newsweek, but don't worry. We've actually got coming up in just a few moments a great interview with Marty Langford, the director of the documentary Doomed, the Untold Story of the Roger Corman Fantastic Four. So stay tuned. Throughout Hollywood history, there have been a number of film projects that were begun with best intentions, but failed to cross the release finish line. Sick or dying actors, disappearing funds, and executives just not happy with how the production was proceeding have all been factors as to why a movie has been shelved before its completion. But there is one film that was completed, but still was never officially released to the public, and that's the Roger Corman-produced adaptation of the comic book The Fantastic Four. Joining us now via phone is documentarian Marty Langford, whose film Doomed, the Untold Story of Roger Corman's Fantastic Four, takes a look at the film's production and the behind-the-scenes machinations that conspired to keep it from theaters. Doomed is now available on Sundance Now. Marty, welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you.
It's been a long journey, as you said, you know, just before we started this. I was, I think, one of the first people who interviewed you about the project for Film Buff Online.
You were, yeah, and you were the very first person I interviewed for the movie Doomed, although you didn't quite make the final cut, did you?
I was about to say, I was the first person to hit the floor, too, wasn't I, in the editing room.
Do you remember when that was? Was that like early 2015 or late 2014? When did I interview you?
I think it was spring of 2015. It was at one of the Chiller Theater shows in New Jersey.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Right, down in East Rutherford. Yes, I remember it well.
Because, you know, I had seen the Facebook posting. You know, I was following the Doomed Facebook page already. And I saw the posting that, hey, we're going to be at Chiller. We're going to talk to fans. And I was like, well, if he's talking to fans, maybe I can get him to talk to me. And this will be a nice piece for Film Buff. And, you know, we were talking. And then you suddenly were like, hey, hold on. Hold on to that thought. Let me get a camera. And I'm like, wait, what?
Exactly, yeah.
Like, this is not going to be a good movie if you want to point a camera at me, for goodness sakes.
sitting outside the hotel there in the grass. It was a beautiful day. The footage looked great. But, you know, it's funny. It was at that point, I didn't have quite the direction that, you know, I ended up having with you. You know, I had originally intended to interview a number of fans and go to cons and talk to dealers and, you know, talk about the legend of this lost movie, you know? But as I got kind of more into it and talking to the principals, the director and the actors and all that, I kind of veered away from kind of that angle and did a more, maybe an investigative piece about just what happened to the film.
Okay, and that kind of change started to probably happen right when you were starting to get more and more of the principals who were involved with the production, correct?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, all I knew was that I wanted to know the story about kind of what happened, and I had been waiting, you know, for somebody kind of to do it, you know, waiting for that book, waiting for that that reveal. And the most comprehensive thing I could find, and I suspect you're familiar with it too, was in the LA Magazine. A writer by the name of Robert Ito did a really nice piece interviewing most of the principal cast and crew. And I kind of used that as a springboard for the doc. I had my buddy Mark Sykes, who is a casting director out in L.A., but who also happened to be the casting assistant for Roger Corman at the time. And, you know, his input and his kind of reach allowed access, you know, to all of the people who were involved. The casting director calls you, you know, you answer the phone. So he was invaluable.
Mm-hmm. And if I remember correctly, Mark's dad used to own a comic book shop that you would go to all the time as kids?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mean, we grew up together in Springfield, Massachusetts, where I still reside. Mark moved out to L.A. in 92. And, yeah, we both worked at his dad's store, Treasure Island, down in downtown Springfield. And, I mean, the best times of my life, you know. Did you ever work comic retail, Rich?
I help out a friend on Alternate Saturdays who owns a shop here in the Wilkes-Barre area. And yeah, it's a blast.
It's terrific. It is, you know. It's just the kind of camaraderie and it's a little community, you know, mm-hmm. tight-knit group. Those are some of the best memories of my life working in that store.
Oh, definitely. I mean, for me, I always love when new customers come in and they're looking for stuff for their kids or their grandkids, you know, and it's almost like being a dealer. You're like, okay, let me see what I can hook these people on.
Yeah, right. You know,
I know.
That industry.
I went in and I've asked you on several occasions, what's a new comic out that I can, you know, hook my stepsons into? And you're like, oh, you've got to check out, you know, Metal from DC and toss it my way. I'm like, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it can be difficult, you know, jumping into a new book, can it, Natasha? Because, you know, you want to have a complete arc. You don't want to start, you know, six comics into some storyline. And you do sometimes need that guidance from, you know, the people that work there.
I'm a big, I collect Scarlet Witch comics. And huh? I don't always make it out to get the newest edition. So from this last arc, I think I'm missing four or five. And I'm sitting here going, what just happened?
And then it becomes a challenge, you know, tracking those books down and hunting for them. And it's a rewarding hobby, although it has gotten expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, you also hunted down a lot of information on the making of Fantastic Four. This is, a great piece of journalism. But you're more of a filmmaker by nature, not a journalist by nature, correct?
Correct, yeah. I teach filmmaking up here in Western Mass at a college. We have a big journalism component to our degree program. But yeah, I don't have kind of a journalism background as much as I do, you know, a filmmaking background.
Mm-hmm.
I was originally going to write a book. You know, I was talking to Mark, trying to get him to get me access to the actors and the director and the writer and the editor and all those guys. And, you know, at some point, after a couple of weeks of kind of, you know, starting to develop an outline, he just kind of asked, he's like, you know, why don't we make a movie? And my fear was that I didn't think we could show any of the film, you know, any of the Fantastic Four. And I didn't want 90 minutes of talking heads. So I had considered it, but I just figured, you know, we'd get sued. And Mark was just like, you know what, let's just do it and see what happens. And we kind of did.
Okay. And that's actually one thing I was wondering about, again, because I rewatched the documentary last night. And there's a lot of footage from this film in your documentary. And I'm wondering, how did you guys skate by getting that much footage in?
Yeah, well, I mean, the fair use doctrine. You know, fair use allows for... you know, not bypassing copyright, but acknowledging copyright. You just have to be careful. You can't show too long of a clip. You can't. We got into a little bit of trouble where we couldn't time shift like the audio channel and the video channel. So if I was using some of the orchestration, the original score, underneath a part of the doc, you know, that was a no-no. I couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the law, or as much of the law as I felt I needed to know. And then once we had finished the film, and I kind of put, I mean, Rich, I was just, you know, going, I was just Google image searching, you know, for a picture of Bernd Eichinger and a picture of, Jack Kirby, and just hoping at some point I'd be okay. But, you know, after we got a distributor and we started going through the legal process, you know, I had to backtrack everything. I mean, every frame of the film, of the doc, had to be gone through. I have this enormous spreadsheet, you know, this 40-some-odd page spreadsheet with frame of kind of each part of the film, each still image, each comic image, each frame of the original film, each, you know, we use, you know, talking about Carl Cerofolio, we use clips from Casino, you know, when he got his head crushed.
Mm-hmm.
And using Jay Underwood, we use clips from Uncle Buck, you know, he was in that. But again, fair use allows that, you know, as long as it's appropriate, you know, to what it is you're discussing in the context of the story, the narrative. And, you know, it was all on the up and up. But, I mean, the fear was, this is, as you prefaced earlier, introducing me, this is an odd duck. You know, this movie isn't legally available. So I was using clips from, you know, from a digital file of a movie that is kind of illegal, you know, to watch. So that was the part that worried us. And, you know, for that, the lawyers and the distributor just kind of said, well, you know, I think we're good. I think we're covered. And we just, you know, went out there with it. And, you know, at different turns, I kept expecting a call. Or we premiered at San Diego at the Comic-Con in 2016. You know what? I think it was 14, Rich, that I interviewed you.
Okay.
Yeah, because we premiered at the 2015 San Diego Comic-Con. But, you know, I half expected, you know, lawyers outside the theater, you know, the briefcase with a cease and desist saying, you can't do this. But it never happened.
So it was very much at one point you just got to be like, well, published and be damned, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. You know, what's the phrase, you know, do and apologize later. And
I believe, you know, phrase is ask forgiveness, not permission.
Perfect. Yes. That's basically that's the credo that we need as filmmakers, to just do, because, you know, I mean, you have to be smart. You can't just outright, you know, steal footage or do something illegally. Although, remember that doc, the one that was shot in Disneyland, covertly?
Oh, yeah. Oh, crumbs, I'm
Escape
blanking them.
From,
Escape from Tomorrowland.
Yes. And, you know, these guys, you know, they did that to the nth degree. They actually shot a narrative film inside the grounds using all of the trademark copyright characters. And Disney ultimately just smartly thought, you know, let's just let them do it. They'll release it. It'll go away. If we make a big stink about it, it's going to be on the cover USA Today, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe Marvel and Fox and Constantine Film maybe thought that about us.
Okay. Yeah, because they never really, they never said anything. But then again, you tried to reach out to them to contribute, and you never heard back.
No, we had one exchange with Constantine. Constantine Film is the German production company who kind of was behind all of this. You know, they're the ones that owned the option back in 92. They're the ones who hired Corman to produce the film for them.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones, you know, depending on who you believe, who ultimately, you know, decided not to release the film. But when we were riding on the coattails of the Joss Trank movie release. So that came out. It was just so opportune. Every article that was talking about the behind-the-scenes trouble that movie was going through mentioned us, and we started kind of, you know, our Q rating, whatever it is, started kind mm-hmm. of going up and up. And we knew that they knew who we were, but, I mean, we had a trailer, Rich, and at one point we were doing, like, I don't know, it was like between 8,000 and 10,000 views an hour. That I'll never forget those days. We ended up getting to about 500,000 views. And I woke up one morning and I went to go check on the views, and that dreaded, you know, this video has been removed for copyright infringement by Constantine Film came up. And what ended up happening was that time shift that I talked about, I used a clip of the Wurst Brothers score under a piece of the documentary. And I guess as soon as they saw that, they realized that we kind of did a boo-boo, and they pulled the trailer. That was devastating, because we didn't quite get to that 500,000. We were like 475 mm-hmm. or something.
Mm-hmm.
But we recut it, reposted it, and then never heard from them again.
Okay. Now, you know, just as I recall from, you know, that time, reading about, oh, there's going to be a Fantastic Four movie, and then it kind of went radio silent, then all of a sudden, all of these urban legends sprang up. It's horrible. They, you know, they can't release it for this or that. And there was a lot of wheat to separate from the chaff there in terms of what actually happened and what didn't. You know, what was the hardest thing to verify as you were going through all of this?
You know, I think it was ultimately the decisions that were made by the entities that we didn't have access to, which would have been 20th Century Fox, Marvel Studios, and Constantine Films. And to some degree, Stan Lee, you know, they were all on record, more or less, of having, you know, said something. Avi Arad, you know, famously said that he burned the negative.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's kind of unprovable. You know, it's an off-the-cuff remark he made, you know, on a beach in Mexico, you know, back in 1994 or 95 or something. So, you know, we can put it out there as, you know, public record, but we can never, you know, conclusively prove that he did indeed do it. Common sense dictates he didn't. I mean, even if you don't intend to release it, even if you're ashamed of it, you're not going to burn the negative. That's just silly. So it was kind of, you know, getting in the heads of the entities that we didn't have access to was the hardest part, you know, so we just had to go by, you know, the people that we had access to and just try to ferret out the truth from there. Hopefully we got close.
Mm-hmm. And I know Avi Arad's comments always struck me as being kind of echoing what I think it was the Salkind said when they said, oh, we chopped 30 minutes out of Superman 4 and we burned all of that footage. And there's never going to be a real director's cut of Superman 4. There's a whole bit of Nuclear Man action that they just chopped right out of the film to get it down to like 90 minutes.
Right, yeah. And even at the time when, you know, the special edition DVDs and Blu-rays, you know, kind of weren't around, they're not doing that. I mean, you know, we're finding footage from, you know, the late 1890s of films that, you know, are still around. We don't destroy. Nobody destroys, you know, intentionally, you know, back time. But who knows? You know, I don't know what Canon... Were the Canon films? Who were the Salkinds with?
It was with Canon by that point.
Yeah, you know, who knows? But, I mean, I've never seen that footage at all the cons that I've been to, so maybe he did get rid of it.
Oh, that would be a shame, because there's got to be a better movie there than what we wound up getting.
Are you a fan of Superman 4?
Not particularly. I like Christopher Reeve's stuff as Superman, but... Man, 3 and 4 are just bad movies, you know, which is a shame. I mean, he's trying to do some good work there. I, you know, appreciate the point he was starting at in the story for Superman 4, which he wrote, saying
social awareness and, you know, global peace and all that good stuff. Sure. Yeah. But, you know, that was great thematically, but yeah, the execution was, oh boy.
Yeah. And even in Superman 3, where he kind of has that split personality fight with himself.
Oh, that's best.
I still love that sequence in an otherwise really terrible movie.
I think that I just saw somewhere on Facebook or God knows where that they had sold, you know, like the dirty costume?
Mm-hmm.
When he was all pissed off and unshaven and he was filthy. And I think they sold off the dirty costume for Superman. That was 3, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
When was the first time you had actually seen the Fantastic Four movie?
Yeah, you know what? It's so funny. I thought about that because as we were kind of, you know, doing press for the movie when it was first coming out, you know, people would always ask that. And I was always, you know, as part of my bio and stuff, it was like, you know, I own 9 different versions of it on, you know, various formats. And I was trying to think of like the year in the con that I would have gotten that first tape. And I think it was 98. Probably the summer of 98 or the fall, maybe, at a Fangoria Weekend of Horrors down in New York at the Hotel Roosevelt when they used to have them there.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I can remember the cover art that I had for the one. It was like a yellow duotone, you know, sleeve and a VHS tape. And I remember watching it. I mean, I remember the tracking lines on the bad dub. I remember, you know, the dropouts. And I mean, I loved it. I know there's the caveat that it was hampered by its budget. And it's not all it could have been, but you know, you can't take away the attributes that it does have. You know, it's a great Doom. It's a great Thing costume. It's loyal to the, you know, the characters of the original, FF, and it has heart and
exactly.
It has charm, you know, it has all that stuff in spades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the thing I remember too about watching it, going, man, oh, it's so cheap, but you know, their heart's in the right place. They're really giving it their all. You know, and I was okay. Yeah, it opens up with what looks to be like NASA educational film footage.
I know.
And I remember I picked my copy up probably at a chiller show or something similar in the late 90s, you know, got home that evening, called everybody and was like, get over here. We're getting pizzas and we're watching this thing. Because at that point, it was still just legendary. You know, no one really, you know, had seen it. Everybody had an opinion apparently about it. And
originally, that was the part of this whole thing that intrigued me most was like, how did the bootleg get out there and who leaked it? And, you know, that fascinated me. And, you know, I think I know how it happened, but it's all kind of hearsay. And there are people who haven't admitted to, you know, or given me a wink, wink when it comes to it. But I'm pretty sure I know how it leaked. I'll tell you off, you know, when we're not recording anymore, if you want. But there was never any kind of conclusive evidence to say that, you know, this is how it happened. Only Sassone, the director, theorizes in the doc, you know, how it might have happened. You know, with some guy at Dupe House, you know, grabbing a copy for himself. But I'll talk to you after we wrap.
Okay, make a note of that. And lastly, though, why can't people seem to make a good quality Fantastic Four film?
I know. I mean, that's the huge question, Natasha. What's your theory? Well, why can't they do it?
I don't know. That is a good question. I find that Fantastic Four is not as relatable a team as it might have been decades ago.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think you have, right.
And based in today's society, I mean, yeah, you have Reed Richards, who is obviously your leader. He's a bit of a brainiac. You have the Thing, who, yeah, he's muscle, but he's also kind of your fluffy teddy bear type, strong, silent. Hot Rod, no pun intended, for Johnny Storm. And then you've got Sue Storm, who is, she's intelligent, but she's kind of your typical blonde bombshell.
And I feel in today's society...
They are just kind of doused down to their stereotypes and not seen as much more than that. So
it's an excellent point.
My thought here is, and this is just me off the top of my head, because I don't think I've ever thought about it this way. We don't have a lot of nuclear families anymore in this country.
Rich, this is my answer, and it's exactly what you're saying. It's that family element. I mean, this is, you look at the roles each of them play, you know, and they are, they're a family, and that element was so important to the Kirby Lee stuff back in the 60s. And I don't know, maybe it's, you know, we see it as kind of banal now, you know, or see it as, you know, I don't know, boring to just, you know, have this family dynamic, you know, when we could be globetrotting with superpowers and lasers and whatever. And they kind of, you know, the other movies have tried to kind of push that element aside. But they should be embracing it, you know, like they did with Corman's film.
And this is just something else that just popped into my head. You said recently, I think, that Jay Underwood is kind of retired from acting and is a minister now?
Yeah, he's a pastor up in Northern California. He doesn't act anymore. He still does cons and shows up and does appearances, but yeah, he stopped acting.
Well, doesn't he know that as having played Johnny Storm, he automatically gets a free pass to play a much better character in a now Marvel movie?
That's funny. I'm trying to think. It was because it was Chris Evans and Michael B. Jordan, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So that's your stepping stone, and then whatever your subsequent roles are going to, you know, you'll be a huge superstar. That's funny.
That's not just in Marvel movies.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, you're also looking at Ben Affleck and Ryan Reynolds as well,
playing good in bad Marvel movies, and then. So right now the film is on Sundance Now streaming service and app.
It is. Yes, that's exciting.
Mm-hmm. And where else can people find it?
Yeah, it's great. You know, the deal we got with Sundance was non-exclusive, so we're still, you know, on your various cable, you know, Comcast and Charter, you know, subscription services. We're on Amazon Prime, on Hulu, iTunes, I mean, almost anywhere you can get streaming. I mean, YouTube. Just go on YouTube, type it in, and you know you can watch it for $2.99. You know, so it's out there. And then physical media, you know, you can either get through Amazon or directly through us through our Facebook page. Actually, your timing's good. We're running this July sale where we're unloading DVDs and Blu-rays like super cheap, like $10. And Mark, my producer, has movie posters from the original film back from 92, some of which are signed by, I think, 7 of the cast members, all the principals and Oli. And, you know, the cheap $100 for the poster and a Blu-ray and some slides, some promotional slides and pins. So, yeah, go check it out on our Facebook page, Doomed, you know, the movie, I think it is.
Definitely, and we'll definitely put a link in our show notes for that as well.
I hope so.
Okay. What's next in terms of movie making?
Yeah, well, you know, this movie took a lot out of me. I mean, it's been done for 2 years, and I, you know, it's not that I have PTSD from it, but any movie that you devote, anything you devote, you know, four years of your life to, you need kind of a recovery period. But Mark and I, Mark has been in Hollywood since 92 as a casting director. He has cast, I mean, go look him up on IMDb, and the credits are, like, you know, awesome. Mostly, you know, B stuff from Oddball Studios, but he was involved with a number of different production companies in the 90s during the video boom. And I think we're looking at maybe a doc talking about that time period, about, you know, the video store era, and specifically one or two of the studios that kind of fed the machine, you know, with these direct-to-video action and exploitation films, you know, starring, you know, Anna Nicole Smith and Eric Roberts. And, you know, the list of those guys goes on forever.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean you will be trekking up to Alaska to one of the last known blockbusters?
Oops, say that again?
Does that mean that you might be making a trek up to Alaska to, I believe it's the last blockbuster in existence?
I thought, it's so funny you say that. Somebody sent me a link to this little kind of short doc about that. It is in Alaska, right?
Yeah.
And they're in a little town, and there's still a rental. And is it a literal blockbuster, like a franchise?
Physical store.
That's funny. I want to go do a little research on that, because that is interesting. And you're right, too. You know, that's an angle. I mean, we just don't have it anymore. I wanted to watch Air Force One, and I tried, like, getting it, you know, and it wasn't on any, you know, the contract that they would have had with Netflix or with Amazon Prime must have lapsed. It wasn't available on either of those sites. It wasn't on iTunes. It wasn't in Redbox. And, you know, there aren't those video stores anymore where you can just walk into and get, you know, pretty much anything you want. And it's, you know, it's kind of a shame. I miss those times. I worked in video retail for years. And I love that period. The 90s were it for me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was nothing better than just taking an hour or two wandering up and down the aisles at a Blockbuster trying to find a couple of things for the weekend. And that was half the experience of watching movies, I think, at home back then.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And better still when they were doing their, you know, sales where they were getting rid of their inventory, and you go in there and look for these deals on, you know, these oddball, you know, horror titles that sat on the shelves and collected dust that, you know, you just wanted in your own collection. I was always a big collector, so I loved owning that stuff.
I was a big Blockbuster kid when I was young. I just remember going there every Friday and picking up movies to last the entire weekend, get like five or six of them.
And that free box of popcorn.
And free, yeah, well, for you guys.
Yeah, I know. You're not a popcorn person, Natasha. I'm sorry.
Who the hell doesn't eat popcorn?
No. Popcorn makes me physically ill. So I can't eat it. And I'm a big movie fan, and I'm at the movies every week. That is my church.
That's weird, man.
I know. I stay away from the concession stand as much as possible. But Blockbuster, I mean, I used to dig through and buy a lot of their used inventory and bring it home. That's how I found a Goodyear, actually.
Oh, okay.
I was going through, and I just came across it and picked it up. I'm like, oh, Russell Crowe, Marianne Cotillard, Freddie Heimer, this one's going home with me. And so when it closed down, I was a bit brokenhearted, because I always told myself if I got a first job anywhere, I wanted it to be at Blockbuster or Barnes Noble. and Blockbuster went out of business, and Barnes & Noble didn't want me. So,
yeah. Barnes & Noble's having their 50% off sale
Criterion,
right now, by the way. So,
well, we had a tornado.
The Criterion disc.
Yeah, we had a tornado recently decide to go through our local Barnes & Noble, and it took out the Criterion wall.
Literally, the one wall of the building that was damaged was the wall where the Criterion sits in the back of the video department.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
An act of God.
It was an act of God to protect my bank account.
I know, right? It was, yeah.
So I actually went online and I committed heresy and I bought my Criterion offline instead of going into the store.
It's not the same.
I know it's not the same, but I had to settle this time. We were in New York at Union Square, and you said to me, Rich,
I thought the Criterion sale, we were there about 2 weeks ago, and I thought the Criterion sale had started that day, and it was actually the day before the sale started, and I was looking at the saddest face I've ever seen in my life when the clerk told us this, and I turned to her, and I'm like, I'm sorry, and I was like,
What were you looking for? Were you looking for anything specific?
I wanted to pick up The Red Shoes and In a Lonely Place and possibly Gilda.
Yeah, I've got a list going too. Yeah, I've got to replace my Brazil. And
I've got a huge list.
The Fire Walk With Me, which I'm on the fence with Fire Walk With Me because I own like the complete mystery. But there's still stuff on the new Criterion disc that's not on there. So it's a new disc. I think it's the same transfer though, but I'll end up buying it.
Yeah, I still have the old Brazil 3-disc set for DVD. So that,
the DVD
at some point,
set,
you get the Blu-ray upgrade.
For that great documentary, The Battle for Brazil. I love that disc.
You have to pick up 8.5.
And I have to pick up 8.5, too.
Oh, 8.5. Oh, my God.
Because Natasha just loaned me 9, which I had never seen. So it's like, okay, now I got to go back and watch 8.5 now, I guess. So, okay. Well, thank you so much for your time, Marty. I know we're kind of getting close to where you need to be heading out for something. Again,
I want to go see Ant-Man and the Wasp.
Well,
that is what we will be reviewing in just a few short minutes.
Yep.
So, did you like it?
We're going to let you listen to the episode in a couple of days and find out.
All right, that's what I'll do.
Okay. But thanks so much. Stick around. There's two end credit sequences in that. Thank you again for your time, and enjoy the movie. Again, everybody, Marty Langford's Doomed is on Sundance now, right now.
Go check it out.
The two mandates of a sequel are the contradictory demands to give moviegoers more of the same stuff they liked in the previous film, while simultaneously expanding the film's world with new characters, location, and story. And when you're a Marvel movie, you have some obligations towards the franchise's ongoing plot lines as well. In Ant-Man and the Wasp, Paul Rudd returns as Scott Lang, the hero who, thanks to the technology built into his supersuit, can change size and communicate with ants. Audiences who didn't go along with Scott on his side trip to 2016's Captain America Civil War may be a bit confused by the new film's opening status quo. But things take off fairly quickly when Hank Pym, played by Michael Douglas, the inventor of the supersuit that Scott uses, and his daughter Hope, played by Evangeline Lilly, recruit Scott to help rescue Hank's wife and Hope's mother Janet from a 30-year imprisonment in the microscopic world known as the Quantum Realm. So, Natasha, after the heavy, dark drama of The Avengers Infinity War, is Ant-Man and the Wasp the light, refreshing sorbet that we need?
Wow!
Oh, it's light. It just makes no freaking sense. It's not a good movie, in my opinion. And I will hold that forevermore.
Wow. It's just, you just did not like it so much, you're just like, I will never be able to reevaluate this movie remaining years on this planet.
It was not a good movie. I'm sorry.
Okay, well, let's start breaking it down. What didn't you like about it?
It reminded me very much of Spider-Man 3 and The Amazing Spider-Man 2 and just how much they tried to pack into this film.
In terms of, like, bad guys?
Yes.
Okay, yeah, there was no one bad guy in this film. You have the ghost, you have Walter Goggins' character, everybody's running around trying to, the FBI guys. They're just throwing a lot of stuff at Scott, it feels like, and none of it's built up enough to be any kind of a menace, and even the sum of its parts is not much of a menace.
Marvel had this great streak of writing wonderful villains over, I would say, the past year and a half to 2 years.
Mm-hmm. And I think we've talked about that before.
Yes. And it felt like this one, they got lazy and they lapsed back into, oh, let's just write a fun movie and we're not going to care about our villain.
The villain's just kind of there to give the hero something to react to.
Yeah, they're not even just there. They didn't need to be there at mm-hmm. this point. And I know that you brought up something that I've been thinking about since you mentioned is how they pretty much made Scott, who was this electrical engineer.
Electrical engineering genius in the first movie.
He's an idiot in this one.
Yep.
He's an absolute idiot who knows nothing of what's going on, which I sort of understand. Quantum mechanics may be a little bit out of his realm of comprehension, but there were...
Realm? I get it. Sorry.
I wasn't even making a pun.
Sorry about that. Go on.
But there were definitely things that he would have understood. Instead, it felt like, oh, we have Paul Rudd. Let's up his comedy level. And let's make Hope and Hank Pym a little more of the serious center to mm-hmm. this film. And I still hold with what I said in the first Ant-Man of, if they just had Hope do it to begin with, you would have never needed Scott.
True.
As she is far better.
Far more competent.
Oh my God, yes.
Mm-hmm.
She's intelligent. She's definitely has training in kicking ass.
Okay, I have a question for you. And it's going to sound like it's off topic at first, but it does circle back. In Spider-Man Homecoming, what grade was Peter Parker in?
I think they had him at 15 or 16.
So, sophomore?
Sophomore, I would say.
Okay.
I'm going to say 15, so freshman, sophomore.
Hmm. Because there's a two-year gap between Captain America Civil War and Ant-Man and the Wasp. That was mentioned with the whole you're in house arrest for 2 years thing for Scott. So... obviously, and since Ant-Man and the Wasp happens roughly right before Avengers Infinity War, where we see Spider-Man and Peter Parker still in school. So it's kind of like, okay, now we have to backtrack to, was Peter Parker a freshman in high school when he was...
I was thinking he was a freshman, particularly in Spider-Man Homecoming, which doesn't take place too long after Civil War.
True. You know, those two are kind of close together, but I always got the thought that maybe he was a sophomore, possibly a junior, just because he's talking about going to a big formal dance, which was normally upperclassmen stuff.
Not always.
Back in the old days when I went to school.
The homecoming dance is a little smaller and more low-key than it is. It's not prom. It's their version of, like, semi-formal.
Okay.
And therefore, lower class can do that.
Mm-hmm.
It was usually like middle school didn't have dances, but once you got to ninth grade and 10th grade, you had your semi, in which also upperclassmen, so juniors and seniors could attend, but juniors and seniors also have the prom for them and them alone.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It was just something that kind of like jumped out at me. I was like, wait, what? Huh? So...
Which is
not really
a junior.
It's
in
not really anymore. Indicative of the film itself or anything.
Yeah,
but it does kind of play into, you know, the shared universe and continuity keeping there.
Mm-hmm.
But let's kind of leave that to the side and focus in on the flaws of Ant-Man and the Wasp.
What did you think of it, Rich?
It was entertaining at spots. There was a lot of fun, creative use of the size changing technology. You know, and making things bigger, making things smaller, That becoming an element of some of the chase scenes. I thought there was some inventiveness there.
Yeah.
But in terms of a story, it was really, really kind of weak. It's just like, okay, we busted Scott out of house arrest, and now we're going to try to find a way to get back to the quantum realm to rescue Janet. And that was it. And, you know, it was just a lot of chasing around for a MacGuffin in the form of the shrunken office building.
Shrunken office building just drove me up the freaking wall, too.
It's an interesting conceit, but then it just became too much.
It became a joke after a while.
Mm-hmm.
At first, yeah, you're right. It was interesting. It was like your own personal workshop that you could take anywhere and set up anywhere without too much hassle. But then it became, oh, there's technology in there. We need it. Oh, we're going to chase after them and get it. And then this one takes it from them. And then, oh, I got it back. And then someone else takes it from you. And it's just, my toy, my part of the sandbox. Leave me alone.
I have a question about the portability of the office building and how you would re-enlarge it back up to regular size anywhere. Well, no, because doesn't this thing have a basement and support structures that are underground?
I don't think it had any structure in the way of a basement. But I did notice that wherever the wheels were placed left a mark as if that was its infrastructure.
And it's the Ant-Man and the Wasp. It's the most ridiculous concept in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Like, I can shrink and control ants. And what's he going to do? Save your picnic? So trying to look for too much logic in this is probably a fool's errand at some point. Paul Rudd's his likable self. I thought Evangeline Lilly was criminally underused. There just wasn't anything to
Michelle
her this
Pfeiffer
film.
Michelle Pfeiffer was underused, as was Forrest Whitaker. Not Forrest. Oh, my God. Lawrence Fishburne. Lawrence Fishburne was just kind of there.
Mm-hmm. I was hoping for more from his character. And really, the moment somebody says, oh, she's changed from being in the quantum realm, you know that she's going to be the character who manages to do the healing that another character needs. And it was just all kind of like a magical plot resolution that was really unsatisfactory.
There were a couple things that I did like, and it's mainly chemistry sections.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly in this one didn't have it.
Nope.
They didn't have the chemistry that they had in the first film. Michael Douglas and Michelle Pfeiffer, however, wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're two veteran actors. They know how, in just the small amount of scenes that they have together, to show, you know, they know how to show that, you know, their characters love each other. And it's, boom, it's obvious, you know, exactly what their whole story is in just the way they, you know, comport themselves between mm-hmm. each other.
And I absolutely loved, and this is something I wish we had had more of in the first film that I'm glad we got a lot of in this one, Paul Rudd and his daughter, Cassie.
Yes, those were nice moments.
They weren't just nice. And they weren't just, oh, it makes sense. No, that was like some of the best chemistry in this freaking film.
Okay. Bobby Cannavale, totally wasted. Judy Greer, again, wasted in this movie like she was in the last one.
Yeah, I think the last one they had more to do than this.
Mm-hmm.
They tried to give more to Michael Peña, but instead he ended up just being the joke again. Yeah.
Why make Michael Peña a comic relief character in a movie that's ostentatiously a comedy? It's ridiculous. It's like, you know, you're gilding the lily at this point.
Which is a shame, because if they toned up the seriousness of this film, him being the comic relief would be perfect, because he's got it. That scene where they give him the freaking truth serum and he goes off on his telling stories. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you get Lewis, he's telling stories. It's
yeah, it's a nice callback to the first film. But at the same time, it's just like, okay,
you're overplaying the joke. Please, something new. Mm-hmm. Something new. The first Ant-Man film felt like a breath of fresh air. We had all of these serious movies, and then Ant-Man comes in. It's fun. It has some comedy. Yeah, there are high stakes, but it's a family film. That's what I loved about so much, is it was a lot about him and his daughter at the end. It wasn't... it's him and trying to get back with his family. Mm-hmm. And I really loved that. It felt very...
But honestly, though...
Bottled down.
Comedy Simple. And themes about family and family connection. We've already seen that in Guardians Volume 2.
To a certain degree. So it's not...
Thematically, this is just a retread, and I don't think it's that good.
It's not. Guardians had more drama to their family dynamic. No offense. They're a dysfunctional family. Mm-hmm. Whereas at least Paul Rudd is trying to be a good father to Cassie. That's one of the things, like I said, I was happy to see was more of that with her. Because we didn't get as much of that in the last film because of Bobby Cannavale and Judy Greer. But there's just it doesn't match up properly in this film. The family dynamic isn't there.
The movie's still going to do great gangbusters at the box office this weekend. That's without a doubt. But honestly, I feel like it's a swing and a miss for Marvel.
It is.
I'm not going to say it's the worst Marvel movie ever. That's still Thor the Dark World.
Agreed.
And it's entertaining in parts, but
it's
overall...
It's a fun watch, but there isn't much there to ground it.
No. It's not one I would go back and rewatch a whole lot of times. I'll probably still wind up buying it because I've bought every damn Marvel movie on Blu-ray.
You want to try about. That one again?
Well, I intend to. I intend to. Okay, there's a couple I'm waiting for sales on. But this doesn't feel like it's a really required film in the franchise.
I also, can we talk about the post-credits, mid-credit and the post-credit?
Okay.
Mid-credit.
Spoilers.
I'm not going to say what they were. The mid-credit made complete sense.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I think everybody wanted from that scene.
But the post-credit? What the hell was that?
Post-credit was ridiculous, including the fact that there's the last shot of the post-credit scene is in the trailer. There's a lot in the trailer that's from like the back third of this movie.
And some of the best parts of the trailer weren't even in the film.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There's,
like, for example, the sequence where you go low, I'll go high. I have wings. Why would I go low? That's not even in the film.
I know. It's
and it's a great line.
It's so weird how they, you know, put these trailers together, the trailer together for this one. And it's just like, wait, how come I'm seeing so much of the action sequences from, you know, the final third of the movie, all the stuff that happens in San Francisco?
Speaking of the big chase scene in San Francisco, is it just me or did that go on for way too long?
It does go on a bit. Yes.
It was just, I'm about ready to fall asleep at one point.
And what's interesting, though, is if you compare it to, like, the trailer from Jurassic World, there's virtually nothing past the first third of the movie in those trailers, with the exception of the one dinosaur going into the girl's bedroom.
Which is funny, because I remember when that first teaser dropped for Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom, and everyone's gone, wow, did they just give away the whole movie?
Yeah, the whole first 30 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, whereas this one, it felt like it was the whole last 30 minutes of the movie.
We're never going to figure Hollywood out, are we?
No, not really.
Okay.
And I think that just about wraps us up for this week.
Remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. So either use the link in the show notes post or head directly there, search and hit subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review because that always helps us connect with new listeners. We'll be back next week with more news analysis and a review of Rob Reiner's new film about journalists in the lead up to the Iraq War, Shock and Awe.
And that's all right here on the Big Picture Podcast. To get down. I'm not in